From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Dark fantasy writer Neil Gaiman is one of those authors with an army of acolytes who turn out all over the world. At book signings, in concert halls where he takes the stage with his wife, rocker Amanda Palmer, online where nearly 2 million follow him on Twitter. He's won the following and every prize out there as what Stephen King calls a treasure house of story. From epic comic strips to novels, he's out with a prequel to his cornerstone work these days, The Sandman. This hour on Point, Neil Gaiman. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's the well Neil Gaiman draws from? What's the nerve, the need he touches? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. Neil Gaiman is author of American Gods, Coraline, The Graveyard Book, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, among many others, winner of the Hugo and Nebula Awards for science fiction, the Bram Stoker Award for horror, and the Newbery and Carnegie Medals for children's literature. Currently writing the story of the video game Wayward Manor, due out next year, his acclaimed comic book series The Sandman ran from 1989 to 1996. Now he's coming out with a prequel series, The Sandman Overture. You can find an excerpt of the first issue and a gallery of images at our website, onpointradio.org. Neil Gaiman joins me in the studio. Neil, it's wonderful to have you. Welcome to On Point.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you, Tom.
You're back in Sandman territory after such a long time. What's it like to be back there?
Really nerve-wracking. I think mostly because when I started writing Sandman, I was somebody nobody had ever heard of doing a comic nobody had ever heard of, and that was lovely because you have nowhere to go but up. I think at the time I looked at it and went, well, if I just get through the first year without being cancelled, I will have won. So that was my goal, was just not to be cancelled.
And you were writing an issue every how many weeks?
Every month.
Once a month, you'd come out, and it would then be illustrated, and off it would go.
Off it would go, and on the stands, 4 months later. So that was what I did. Actually, what was hard was when I started, it was all very, very new and exciting for me, and I would take about 2 weeks to write a Sandman episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took 3 weeks every month. And then I took 4 weeks every month, which was really pushing things. And by the end of it, I was taking about 5 weeks a month.
And your publishers must have been holding their head in their hands.
They were incredibly nice. They've always been incredibly nice with me. This is the wonderful DC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
But they definitely had to cope with the fact that toward the end, deadlines got a bit stretchy, as it just took me longer and longer to do it. And also, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that more and more people were finding Sandman back then. More and more people were reading. By the end, we were outselling Batman and Superman.
We'll have listeners who know the Sandman series so well. They'll know it nearly frame by frame. I mean, you have that kind of reader with that kind of devotion. We'll have others who just have no idea. Would you be so generous as to kind of lay out the story of this epic series that made Neil Gaiman Neil Gaiman?
Absolutely. Sandman, the classic Sandman, was 75 issues in comic book form.
Literally, each one an individual comic book sold in stores.
Absolutely. And now collected initially into 10 volumes. And more recently, you can buy them in 4 huge, oversized, Bible-shaped volumes. And for the anniversary, they've just done something which is quite impressive. They've got it down to 2 omnibus volumes containing the whole thing, which are, it's over 2,000 pages.
I mean, it began as individual comic books in the series, I should say, but now it looks like a graphic novel in volumes.
Absolutely. These graphic novels, and you can get them from, go down to your local bookstore. They've got them. They also have them in huge leather-bound editions and stuff like that. It's a story about stories, I guess. It's the story of Morpheus, the Sandman, the personification, the anthropomorphic personification of dreaming,
mm-hmm.
rules your dreams. He is essentially dream, and he is part of a family of 7, destiny, death, desire, despair, delirium, and destruction.
All characters.
All characters, all personifications of their own rather peculiar worlds, or with very different sort of personalities. When I started writing them and I'd come over to America, people would say to me, you know, you've created the ultimate dysfunctional family. And it wasn't a phrase I'd ever heard before. And I'd say, what do you mean by dysfunctional family? And they'd explain. And I realized after a while that what Americans meant by dysfunctional family is just what we in England call a family.
Plain and simple.
Absolutely. So they're a family. This is his story, and it's a story that begins with him being captured for
75 years
or something. Mm-hmm. Exactly. By a strange black magic organization, kept prisoner in a Sussex cellar. And it's what happens when he gets out, who he is, how he's been changed. And I suppose when I started it, I'd never written a monthly comic. I'd never had to tell one story a month. I'd written and sold short stories. But the idea that I was going to have to do something every month, I thought, well, I'd better do something that allows me to go anywhere and everywhere. So I thought, right, I will have a lead character who has been around since the dawn of time. That gives me the whole of human history to play with. I will have, if I want gods and devils, I can put them in. If I want fairies, I can put them in. If I want Norse gods, if I want to do something small and human, I can do that. And if I need to, I can leave him out entirely. I can just do a story in which he's tangential. His presence is off to one side. And I got to do that. A 75-issue story that is really one huge story. It starts with Preludes and Nocturnes. And continues all the way through to the final volume, which is called The Wake.
With this incredible illustration throughout, it evolves over the course of the issues, but it's got this kind of goth, Victorian, and contemporary all somehow at once look to it.
What was fantastic.
Spectacular.
Thank you. I got to use the most wonderful artists in comics, and still with Overture, I'm still having that as a privilege. Normally, the tradition with comics was that you would be an artist-writer team forever. For various reasons, Sam Keith, who started Sandman, retired early. He retired after issue 5 and just said, he said, look, this is great, but I feel like Jimi Hendrix in the Beatles. I'm in the wrong band. He was taken over by a wonderful artist named Mike Dringenberg. Mike stuck it for another couple of years, but didn't like the monthly deadline thing.
It's demanding. There's an amazing amount of illustration here.
You have to sit there and keep drawing and keep drawing. I think it's bad as a writer, but, you know.
Right. This never ends. And they're elaborate illustrations.
So Mike then retired. And after that, we decided that it would be easier to find the right artist for the right storyline, which was a complete break with tradition. Mm-hmm. So for a story called Season of Mists, which was big and grandiose and in hell, I had a marvelous artist named Kelly Jones. Mm-hmm. For a story called Brief Lives, which was much more human, much more just all about real people standing around talking, I used a fantastic artist called Jill Thompson. And what was great is I walked away with all of these friends. There were probably 100 people who worked on Sandman during the course of those 75 issues.
How did the back and forth work between you writing the text and them illustrating? Were you tweaking as you went? Did you just hand it to them and take off and it was all up to them from that point?
What you do, and this is something that I'd wanted to know since I was a kid. I was a kid reading comic books as I read everything. And I particularly loved American comics because they'd come over to England and they were like postcards from Oz. They were just these strange, wonderful things. And I'd think, how do they get written? I knew what a movie script looked like. I'd seen them. But I couldn't get my head around what a comic script was. And eventually, a marvelous comics writer, probably the finest writer of comics there has ever been, a man named Alan Moore, just showed me how to write comics. And he sat down and he said, right, he said, right, Neil, I'll try and do Alan's accent. He said, right, Neil, you write page 1, panel 1, and then you say everything that's happening in that panel, In this case, you know, you'd say page one, panel one, Neil Gaiman and Tom Ashbrook are sitting in a studio. There is paper all over the desk. There are great big microphones. Neil is talking, waving his hands around, doing an impression of Alan Moore. Tom is nodding sagely.
And it's like stage direction.
Absolutely, stage direction. And it's a letter to an artist. Mm-hmm. And then underneath you'd write, you know, Neil, Tom, it's stage directions. Neil, it's a letter to an artist. And those will be what will go into the word balloons. Mm-hmm. Neil, thought balloon, I'm so glad they got me that cup of tea.
And what about tone, mood, look?
Absolutely. You put everything. As far as I was concerned, and still to this day, as far as I'm concerned, a comic script is a 10,000-word letter. Mm-hmm. To an artist. People said, I would always get puzzled when people would say to me, so you write comics, so you write the words that go in the balloons. And you're going, no, that's actually very absolutely the tip of the iceberg.
The icing on a very big cake.
Yes, what I'm doing is building the cake. And those words, I will tell the artist everything I want to be in the panel, the size of the panel, the shape. But you also don't want, what you're also doing is working with some of the most creative people in the world.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling fantasist, dark storyteller, writer of the Sandman comic series, Neil Gaiman. He's out with a prequel to the Sandman series, The Sandman Overture, joins me in the studio today. Of course, his work, we've seen it up on the big screen. His 2002 novella Coraline was adapted into a stop-motion film directed by Henry Selick in 2009. Here's a scene where Coraline walks into a room to find the other mother with buttons in place of eyes that has replaced her real mother.
Mom? What are you doing here in the middle of the night?
You're just in time for supper, dear.
You're not my mother. My mother doesn't have...
Buttons?
Do you like them?
I'm your other mother, silly. Now go tell your other father that supper's ready.
The other mother from Coraline, and we're in strange territory. Yes, fantasy delivered by Neil Gaiman. Also advice that lots of people in the arts and beyond have followed. In May last year, he delivered the commencement address to the University of the Arts graduating class of 2012 in Philadelphia. He spoke about the freelance life, really the artist life.
A freelance life, a life in the arts, is sometimes like putting messages in bottles on a desert island and hoping that someone will find one of your bottles and open it and read it and put something in a bottle that will wash its way back to you. Appreciation or a commission or money or love. And you have to accept that you may put out hundreds of things for every bottle that winds up coming back.
Neil Gaiman, on how it all works and what it takes to sort of work your way into a life in the arts. Now you've got a prequel to The Sandman. We'll look at that. But what's your prequel? Before you sat down and began to churn out these 75 issues, I mean, what was it that filled you with such a depth of story, this treasure house of story that Stephen King talks about? Where did that come from?
I genuinely don't know, and I so wish I had a proper origin story. You know, characters in comics have, you know, Spider-Man got bitten by a radioactive spider. I wish I'd been bitten by a radioactive story.
But and were you really not? I mean, how could you not? There's all these allusions to the great myths of human history here.
I was a bookie kid. Mm-hmm. I loved books. Mm-hmm. I loved spending my life in books. I loved spending my time in books. I was the kind of kid. I remember getting my parents to drop me off in my summer holidays on their way to work. They'd drop me off at the local library. And I would just head back into the children's library, get the card catalog, and just go through it and just start reading my way through. I remember loving all tales of myth, tales of the Norsemen, tales of ancient Egypt. They were by a man called Roger Lanceling Green, and I adored them. I loved C.S. Lewis. I remember discovering age 9 in the school library, J.R.R. Tolkien. Mm. They had a very ancient battered copy of The Hobbit, and they had the first two volumes in, again, ancient and battered hardback of The Lord of the Rings. And I read them over and over and over again, and when I finally won the school English prize, they asked what I wanted, because I could have any book I chose, and I chose The Return of the King so I could find out how it all ended.
Here's my question. I read your bio on this front, and I recognized it immediately. In many ways, it was like mine. I was one of these book, you know, mad kids, and whenever I wasn't out working on the farm, I'd be just headed for those books and could not tear myself away from them. But you came out of all that with this kind of dark cast to your fiction. I don't write fiction, but I also don't feel that dark cast exactly. And I'm always curious about, we read almost the same vein, you know, good overlap anyway, and yet one kind of leans light and one kind of leans dark. Where does that come from? Or is that just the path you took to publishing?
You know, the strange thing is that if you'd asked me when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, if you'd said, okay, you are going to get to grow up to be a writer, mm-hmm. that actually will happen.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the future. Here is the future. Mm-hmm. You're in the future and you've got to be a writer. Guess what kind of writer you grew up to be?
Yeah.
I would have said, oh, okay, I'm a hard science fiction writer, aren't I? I'm like Larry Niven.
Yeah.
I'm an Arthur C. Clarke.
Yes.
I'm an Isaac Asimov.
Yes.
That's what I thought I probably...
The aspiration or the expectation.
The expectation
were there.
In mm-hmm. my head. Mm-hmm. And instead, I think the people that I loved and responded to, looking back at it, as I grew a little bit older, the Harlan Ellisons, the Ursula K. Le Guins, Samuel Delaney, Roger Zelazny, writers like that, plus... I also started to really fall in love with some of the writers, the darker writers out there.
Mm-hmm.
People like Robert Aikman, who's almost forgotten. Some of the horror people like Ramsey Campbell. And, of course, Stephen King came along. And Stephen King showed me how good storytelling could be when it got a little dark. And I think what I loved about that is what people under stress... show themselves. You can actually start to examine how people think, how they behave, how they act when you put them into pretty nasty places. What I love about my career is that I'm actually not a horror writer. I know lots of horror writers. I love them. They're always the happiest people on earth.
Right.
As far as I can tell, happiness seems to
work it all out.
It is. Comedians are always miserable.
Yes.
I've never met a comedian who wasn't just sort of sad or
head in hands.
Head in hands, just awful. Yeah. And they never laugh at things. You tell them something funny and they go, that's funny.
Right.
But horror writers, they're just happy, lovely people because they get it all out. And I am not of their number. I get to walk into their territory. I get to use horror, I guess, as a condiment. But I never get to live there the whole time.
But fantasy, certainly, often dark fantasy. I mean, I look in your bio, a Jewish kid in the UK, which can have its own stresses.
Yeah.
Parents deeply involved with the Church of Scientology, which has its own elaborate mythology. Can we connect dots here in terms of where you would end up going with your writing?
I don't know. It's that awful thing where people say, well, is this what produced you? And I go, I don't know. This is the only life I got.
Yeah.
We can't actually go in and do a test run with changing some of the variables and suddenly produce the version of me that would have gone, yes, I am a realtor.
or not,
whatever. The version of me that we've got. What I do love the fact that I'm allowed to do everything. I love the fact that this year, my year began with a book called Tuesday, picture book for little kids.
Mm-hmm.
Then went to a book called Unnatural Creatures, which I edited, which was a benefit for 826, the literacy program.
Mm-hmm.
I did we brought up the speech I gave, Make Good Art, that graduation speech, as a book. Then I brought out The Ocean at the End of the
Range,
which is a very, very personal, very dark, very strange book about me, age 7. Probably it's the best portrait of me as a kid you'll get in with other stuff. And that was followed by a book called Fortunately the Milk, which is my children's book. It's currently, I don't know, I think it's 10 weeks now on the New York Times bestseller list. And it is simply silly.
I thought you were tweeting and touring all the time. How do you turn out that kind of production rate?
Well, I have actually promised myself that next year I'm taking a social media sabbatical. I'm, for at least 6 months, I'm going to retire from Twitter, probably dial down my presence on everything else. If I can, I'll do significantly less email and write a lot more. But I'm also planning to teach next year.
You're going to have people banging on their smartphones looking for those tweets. We've got a lot on the line right now waiting to speak with you. Neil Gaiman is with us, author of The Sandman and so much more. He's out with a prequel to that epic comic series, The Sandman Overture. With me in the studio today, how wonderful. Let's go to our callers. Amanda in Hazard, Kentucky, no less. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air with Neil Gaiman.
Hi, this is amazing. Neil Gaiman's been my favorite author, I guess, forever since I actually started reading.
Why, Amanda? What is it about his work?
It's amazing. I love how he ties in the mythology. I've always really been into mythology. His books are the only books I've ever actually read more than once. The very first issue of Sandman that I picked up was the very last issue of the series. So that was really sad. I didn't discover it until the very last issue, but they started reprinting them immediately, so I got to read it.
And do you read them still? Are you still?
Yes, I have the graphic novels. Yes, I read them all the time. And the books are amazing. I just want to thank him for all the wonderful literature that we have.
So here he is. He's right in front of you.
Hello,
you're in
Amanda.
Hazard. He's here. What's your question for Neil, Amanda?
The creative process, for you, does it? I know a lot of things I dream, and then I wake up and I want to write them down. Do you have that?
I do sometimes. I get very frustrated because dream logic isn't story logic. And although I've a couple of times I've very proudly brought back things, especially when I was writing Sandman, I'd have a weird, vivid dream and go, okay, I can use that little bit. The biggest problem with dreams as stories is something that you find when you try and tell people your dreams and you realize that so much of it is subjective. You get to the point where you're going, well, I was walking down a corridor and things were getting scarier, but I didn't know why they were getting scarier. And then I walked into my kitchen and I looked in the fridge and there was a swimming pool. And you see people's eyes glaze over and you go, oh, I wish I could make them feel what I felt.
But so what's the difference? You take us quite fantastic places in your illustrated work. Even what you just described, I could easily imagine in one of your stories. Why is one untranslatably subjective and the other story in your hand?
Story logic isn't dream logic. Dream logic isn't story logic. And you can absolutely, and some every now and again it is. I think I one short story, I actually woke up with a plot and went, that actually is a real thing.
Is it a through line theme? Is it a larger narrative to contain it? I mean, you've got fantastical stuff right and left.
I think it's part of it is a matter of consistency and also a matter of identity. It's that point where you wake up and you go, oh, that's a great story. And then you start trying to explain it to, in my case, my wife, Amanda. And at the point where I'm going, well, it was my teacher. And then we were talking, but he wasn't my teacher anymore.
Yeah.
He was a large dog. And, you know, that sort of strange thing. But that's also really fun and wonderful if you're looking for imagery. When I was in my 20s, I used to have nightmares. And I would wake up terrified from horrible, horrible nightmares. And when I started writing Sandman, I would wake up from horrible nightmares and I'd go, oh my gosh, that was terrifying. I was being pursued down corridors by somebody with a face like writhing spaghetti. And then I go, oh, that's so good.
Grab that.
And I think after very, very rapidly, the nightmares stopped. I think my theory was that whoever was doing it was just going, I don't know, it's not working.
So it takes more than scribbling down the dreams, even just for the images. Amanda, thanks for your call. One more right here. Fred in New Britain, Connecticut. Fred, you're on with Neil Gaiman.
Hi, Tom. My comment slash question was hello?
Yes, you're on, Fred.
I'm sorry. My regard was to the Good Omens book you collaborated with Terry Pratchett on. I would just like to say I really appreciated the seamless yet distinct bits that you guys each wrote in the book. Though it was a collaboration, there was always parts where I was saying to myself, yep, Neil Gaiman wrote that, you know, especially creepy parts, you know. And I'd like to say, like, when did you find yourself collaborating with Terry Pratchett? What was the... the genesis of that project?
Well, the genesis of that project, I wrote a book, a nonfiction book called Don't Panic, which was a guide to the work of Douglas Adams and the history of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And when I finished that, I thought, you know, I can actually write in this style. I've just learned how to do classic British humor. And I had an idea for a book, the working title of which was William the Antichrist, about a small boy who is, the baby swap at the beginning of the movie The Omen goes wrong, and they actually lose track of the baby, mm-hmm. and he goes off and gets brought up as a completely normal kid. And I wrote 5,000 words of this, sent it to a couple of friends, one of whom was Terry Pratchett, to look at, and then started writing Sandman. And Sandman took up all my time, and about 8 months later, I got a phone call from Terry saying, yeah, that thing that you sent me, are you doing anything with it? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, no, I'm really busy. And he said, well, do you want to either sell me the idea because it's so good, or let's just do it together? And I, because I was nobody's fool, and that's an awful lot like having Michelangelo call you up and saying, yeah, let's just paint on a wall sure, this weekend.
Sure. Or a ceiling.
Yeah. It's like, I'm going, okay, I'm in. So I said, right, let's do it together. And it was great. Mostly, it was a process of I would write my bits at about 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm. I was very nocturnal back then, and I'd probably finish at about 6. And I'd wake up, and there'd be a flashing light on my answering machine, and I'd press the button, and the tape would rewind, because we had tapes back
then.
Yeah,
sure.
And Terry would say, get up, you lazy so-and-so, I've just written a good bit. And I'd call him, and he'd read me whatever he'd written that morning, and I'd read him what I'd written much, much earlier that morning, and then we'd basically just try and make the other one laugh. We had no idea if this thing was saleable. He wasn't Sir Terry Pratchett at that point.
Yes.
I wasn't Neil Gaiman. We were just two friends. Exactly. We were two friends who had this goofy idea. And with an audience of each other. So absolutely, some of the times when you're reading bits and going, ah, that's definitely Neil, you're probably right, because especially if it has maggots in it. But, you know, there was a certain amount of joy in doing each other's stuff. I wrote pretty much all of the death in there, speaking in capitals and stuff, because that was Terry's death, and I loved the character of Terry's death, so I thought it'd be fun to put him in and fun to write him.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling fantasist, dark storyteller, writer of the Sandman comic series, Neil Gaiman. He's out with a prequel to the Sandman series. It is the Sandman Overture. Neil Gaiman is with me in the studio today. In May 2012, he was on stage delivering the commencement address to the University of the Arts graduating class of 2012 in Philadelphia. And here he spoke about enjoying your work.
Stephen King liked Sandman, and my novel with Terry Pratchett, Good Omens, and he saw the madness that was going on, the long signing lines, all of that stuff, and his advice to me was this. He said, this is really great. You should enjoy it. And I didn't. Best advice I ever got that I ignored. Instead, I worried about it. I worried about the next deadline, the next idea, the next story. There wasn't a moment for the next 14 or 15 years that I wasn't writing something in my head or wondering about it. And I didn't stop and look around and go, this is really fun.
Neil Gaiman giving advice to those who would be artists Be careful what you enjoy and when you enjoy it, I guess. Don't fail to, but watch out as well. Neil Gaiman is with me in the studio. I read somewhere you talking about reading Joseph Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces, and at some point, which is kind of, you know, what he sets out to explain, this sort of myth that lies in, an story that lies underneath, in a way, all others. And at least in the telling that I read, you got some way into that book and put it down and said, no.
Stopped.
Why? Why?
Yeah, I'd read The Masks of God, the Joseph Campbell sort of giant religious trawling, and had loved that. And promptly went out and bought Hero with a Thousand Faces. Got probably 20% of the way through it and just thought, you know, I shouldn't know this.
Don't want to know too much.
I don't want to know this.
It would hem you in.
If it's true, and if it's actually true, if I'm doing it, I'll do it anyway.
That story will be floating through there somewhere.
It's going to work. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't true, then I don't want this in my head. And if it is true, I probably shouldn't have it spelled out in my head. I would much rather come across it. I'd much rather have the feeling of discovery. And every now and again, I've found myself in meetings in Hollywood where they've obviously studied the Hero with a Thousand Faces.
To as death.
Absolutely to death. And you will hand in your script and they'll say, you know, I don't see the reconciliation with the father in there anywhere. And you're going, you know, it's not actually compulsory.
Yes.
I know it worked for Star Wars,
but it's
not compulsory.
The illusion that you're famous for, to all kinds of literary and mythological references, and then ancient Shakespeare, Freud, right up to date. Did you give yourself an education beyond that childhood reading education, sitting with those great tomes, or is it just ambient? Is it just embedded at some part of your mind?
I tend to think, or partly as a writer, I tend and have tended over the years to love researching. It was actually the most peculiar thing for me about writing Sandman, which is I'd never been a history buff at school. I'd been vaguely interested, but never thought of myself as being particularly into it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly I'm writing stories. I'm going, well, I'm actually going to need to know about the French Revolution to write this story. So I would plunge into every book I could read about the French Revolution. I'd be plunging into books on history. Suddenly economics would become interesting if I was going to have, if things were going to have effects in the real world. I wound up looking back on it, having this sort of glorious, enforced, rapid education in things. Although I still think that the finest education I had as a writer was being a book reviewer.
Dissecting, taking apart what others were doing, what worked, what didn't, or what
no,
about it?
No, actually, just because I suddenly found myself in my early 20s having the kind of book reviewing jobs where books would come in piles and I would read them, and I was being forced to read way outside my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had to, and it's one of those things I now recommend to young writers, I say, look, if you love fantasy, don't read fantasy. You know, read a little of it for pleasure, but go and read everything else. Read biography. Read history. Read the stuff that you're actually going to need if you're going to create a world. If you love romance novels, read other things. Anything, what you bring back from other places is going to inform everything that you write.
How do you picture the heart of your audience, the ideal adult Neil Gaiman audience? Who's that ideal reader for you? Who's going to respond to the sort of dark fantasy treatment?
95% of the time I'm writing for me. My in my head, my audience is simply me. It's a version of me that isn't writing the story, doesn't know what's going to happen next, but likes the kind of thing that I like.
Okay, describe that audience then. It turns out to be yourself, but as a target, as an audience, what distinguishes that core audience?
Literate, actually able to read with pleasure. Somebody who is going to enjoy rereading with increased pleasure. somebody for whom I can hide all sorts of Easter eggs, all sorts of little treasures in the text that will seem like they're natural the first time through. And when you go through the second time, you should be going, oh, my gosh, he did this. I can't believe I didn't see that the first time through, but it was there staring me right in the face.
What is it in that audience that takes him to that darkness? What is it? Is it a wound? Is it awareness of a heightened awareness of mortality and mystery? I don't know.
The thing that baffles me and baffled me more recently with Ocean at the End of the Lane, because Ocean at the End of the Lane came out and was an, you know, honest to goodness, actual, proper, really and truly bestseller. It knocked Dan Brown off the number one spot in the New York Times. It was a real one. So, when that happens, you get a weird phenomenon also occurring, which is people who are not your fans go, oh, this has been the number one bestselling book. I will go and pick it up. And occasionally seeing the bafflement of those people going, I don't understand what I just read. What was that about? Why would you want to have stuff that was made up? That for me is as puzzling in some ways as people saying, well, why would you put this stuff in?
So how do you interpret
that? I put that stuff in.
Well, what's the dividing line in reader between those who just get it and they're so there for you and they're legion and those who pick it up because it's on the bestseller list and say, what?
I think part of it is a willingness to imagine. And part of it is actually an understanding of metaphor. Part of it is people people who are not very good at metaphor tend to look at the world the way that it is and go, this is the world, this is the way that it is. If you are writing about anything that is outside of my personal experience, you are writing nonsense. For me, I look at the world and I go, so much of the way that I see the world and the things I see people reacting to, behaving about, arguing about are fundamentally things that come from the human imagination. Whether you're talking about people having huge political disputes over essentially tiny religious points, doctrinal points, which when you're getting down to it, you're going, okay, so you people are technically throwing bombs at each other.
Over this?
Over this. You're arguing about whether a piece of wafer actually literally or merely metaphorically becomes the body of somebody who died 2,000 years ago. You are really, and that's why you guys are blowing each other up. And they'll say, well, no, it's not about that, but it is about that. Or Sunni and Shiite Muslims, or the point where people are flying planes into the World Trade Center trying to attack the Pentagon because they feel that their God is somehow telling them to do it or will be pleased. You're going, well, these are giant imaginary things. They come from the human imagination. At some point, somebody made them up, and this is a world.
It makes
a
world.
Yes, it really does. It's like, when people tell me that imaginary things aren't important, I tell them to go on Google Maps and look at the satellite picture of the Earth and show me where country borders are.
Yeah. Yes, we've imagined a lot.
They're all made up. You know,
a lot.
Things that are imaginary are just as important. Because all we have to do is agree on them being real and they become real. And that fascinates me.
Nicole in Attleboro, Massachusetts. Nicole, you're on the air with Neil Gaiman.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Neil. I just wanted to, first of all, thank Neil for just the way you've inspired me as an artist. Your Make Good Art speech has just encouraged me in my own writing, and I love what you write, and I'm so glad you've written so much because it means I can keep reading for a long time. So I'm really grateful for that. I'm also just coming off the Day of the Doctor yesterday, the Doctor Who episode, 50th anniversary special.
Yeah.
Your episode that you wrote, The Doctor's Wife, the one line that Idris says when she asked the doctor about people, are all people like this? Are all people so much bigger on the inside? I feel like that encapsulates not just all of Doctor Who, but that's what we're trying to capture when we write. We're trying to capture the bigness of the inside of people. And so I just wanted to know, first of all, how you got involved in Doctor Who. Like, were you always a fan? And just thank you for writing about the bigness that's inside of people.
Wonderful, Nicole. Wonderful.
You are so welcome, Nicole. And honestly, I think if fiction has a point greater than entertainment, it is actually the thing of teaching us that other people exist. It teaches us empathy. It teaches us that inside every other eye is a person too. And that, I think, is so huge. So I'm really grateful that you responded to that. Doctor Who, I was a three-year-old kid, and the kids at my kindergarten were playing with little milk bottles and making them into Daleks. And I thought, this is the strangest thing in the world. I have to know what this is.
Making them into what?
Daleks, these little robots that look like sort of Pepper Pot-shaped Haiti metal death machines with eye stalks and toilet plungers as weapons. And I loved this. I loved them. I would go to my grandparents and watch episodes of Doctor Who, and I would watch them from behind the sofa so the things couldn't get out and
that.
Get me.
Yeah.
I got my parents to buy me the Doctor Who annual every year, this sort of publication that came out. And I think Doctor Who did an awful lot to shape the way that I saw the world. You know, talking about those things that shape you and those things that create you. Doctor Who was huge for me. The idea that the world is not the way that it seems, the idea that you can solve things by ingenuity, that fists are not the answer.
Turn it, see another angle, inside.
You know, the joy of Doctor Who was that it was always about intellect over brawn. Nothing was ever solved in Doctor Who by somebody being bigger or stronger than somebody else. It was always about being smarter. And that, I think, kept me that was what hooked me. I loved it. I loved the mythology. Again, I would create this personal mythology. And I remember my delight in 2005 when Doctor Who came back on the air after a hiatus, and my then 12-year-old daughter, Maddie, and I would watch it together. And it just became this fantastic parent-child bonding show. And so getting to write episodes of Doctor Who was you know, it was my dream job.
Donnie writes to us on Facebook. He says, video games have sort of replaced the paperback media for much of today's youth. Do you see yourself writing something for a video game? I know you're doing that. How do you think about it?
I've done one so far. I've been playing around with a game with these wonderful guys called the Odd Gentlemen, who I met, I loved. I loved the way they thought. And we put together our love for 30s screwball comedies and things like Blithe Spirit and Arsenic and Old Lace, and came up with a story which they're turning into a video game, which should be out early next year, called Wayward Manor.
It's a long way from Grand Theft Auto, or is it?
Oh, it's a long way from Grand Theft Auto. It's much, much sillier. Essentially, you are a ghost in a house, and there are people hanging around your house, and your job as a ghost is to drive them out of your house, which you can do by sending them mad, terrifying them, all the kinds of things that you'd like to do.
Does it have the range of possibility of the comic? More, less, the same?
It's a video game. It's a different kind of thing. For me, I feel so lucky. I meet people who are novelists, let's say, and what they do is write novels. And I'm always in awe of them, just as I'm in awe of anybody who has a profession. I'm like a kid in a candy store. I feel like, in fact, very literally, I feel like a kid who's been locked in an old-fashioned candy store overnight. At 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, somebody's going to open that door, and I need to get my arm into as many big jars as I can.
Different media.
Absolutely. So I love the fact I've got to do comics, I've got to make television, I've got to do movies, I've got to write novels, I get to do short stories, now video games. I love doing radio plays. It's one of the lovely things about the BBC is they still drama. And I wish that radio drama would come back to America. Getting to write poetry, getting to write essays. I love it. I'm so lucky.
It's all there. And certainly a lot of people ready to read and take on board whatever you put out there. Neil Gaiman, nearly 2 million on Twitter, and he says you'll check out for 6 months next year on that. Get ready to go cold turkey. His latest is the Sandman Overture prequel to the epic comic series. Neil, so wonderful to talk with you today. Thank you so much for coming in. Great to have you here.
Oh, the time just flew, Tom. That was amazing.
It has. Wonderful. Thanks for joining us. Listeners, thank you for all your comments as well. Thanks for being with us today. Tomorrow we look at the movies coming up in the new holiday season. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.